Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-1139, Fred Leroy Pasternak, Petitioner versus National Transportation Safety Board et al. Ms. Yotis for the petitioner, Mr. Conninley for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kathleen Yotis, and I'm representing Dr. Pasternak in the case before you. Before we get into the unnecessarily complex arguments in the briefs, we believe it is important to emphasize to the court at the outset that at the root of this case, this is a very simple issue. The government charges Dr. Pasternak with refusing to take a required drug test. In fact, and undisputed, Dr. Pasternak did take a required test in accordance with the procedures for the processing of that test, and it was proved negative, or it tested negative for any illicit drugs. That simplicity, I think, gets lost in the complexity, and want to make sure to emphasize that to the court.
You say that he took the test in accordance with the required procedures, but that's the issue before us, isn't it?
Part of the procedure is the issue of Dr. Pasternak leaving the facility before providing a second specimen. But what I'm saying is, in accordance with the procedures that were being applied that day, and accordance ultimately with the procedures for processing a test, in other words, the chain of custody issues and the testing for that sample, all of that was conducted in accordance with the regulations. And in this case, there is no refusal. He took a test, and it was proved negative for drugs. Dr. Pasternak is charged with refusing to take a test, not charged with a regulation that says no person may leave a facility. It's a regulation that says no person may refuse a test. That is the point that we're trying to get across in its most simple format, if you will, for simple message. Again, that it doesn't make sense that simply or technically leaving constitutes a refusal. That's arbitrary in a sense because, again, it doesn't make untrue the fact of the test. If there are any questions from the court, I would certainly be delighted to answer them.
Okay. Are you, part of your argument, in your brief at least, is that he was not, the test was not appropriately applied to him. Are you abandoning that argument?
The argument that we're making, I think if I'm understanding your question correctly, is that the way the test was administered, the conduct of the collectors and the telephone calls back to the employer and what have you, were not in, and the filling out of the CCF, the custody and control form, were not in strict accord with the regulations if there was, in fact, a refusal to test.
So I understand that, but I thought that part of your argument was that he should not have been in the pool of employees who were subject to random testing.
That is another argument that we are making, that he should not have been included in the pool in the first place, so that he should not have been eligible to have been called to take the test. And that argument is based on the definitions in the regulations that the people who are in the pool are employees, covered employees, who are performing safety-sensitive functions, performance being defined in the regulations as somebody who is performing the functions immediately, operating the aircraft, if you will, as an example, ready to perform or immediately available to perform. That is, they're ready to be called and can show up at the airport and go fly the airplane, make a plan to be available to go ahead and take a trip. But in this case, Dr. Pasternak did not fall within that definition.
Could he have gone to the airport and done his 2 hours of training and then performed?
Well, Your Honor, yeah, and I see that you're picking up on the fact that there was testimony that recurrency could have been achieved, in as little as 2 hours, but it could have taken more than that.
By doing what?
The recurrency for instrument testing, if I'll recall, and I'd have to go back and change the regulations, so I'm going on based on my own knowledge of the regulations as a pilot, is that you have to conduct certain maneuvers in accord with a flight instructor or an examiner. So you are operating the aircraft under instrument rules, meaning you're looking simply at your instruments and not outside the airplane. So you would have to go through a check ride, a test, if you will, with somebody to assure that you still have the skills to fly the airplane solely paying attention to the instruments.
And that could have been done in a few hours.
It could have been, or it could have been longer than that, and there's no assurance that anybody would have passed such a check.
So if they needed him for tomorrow, he could go out today and try to get recertified or current.
There could have been a discussion as to whether that would have been possible or not, but there's no assurance that it would have been possible or that there would have been a successful outcome. So we don't know that. And that is speculative. The regulations are talking more in terms of who is ready to perform, immediately available to perform, as a pilot right now. They're on a roster ready to be called.
How do you get off the roster?
Well, I suppose there are many circumstances. I don't run any Part 135 companies, but the testimony in the record was if somebody's no longer a pilot, they are taken off the record.
Or if they're no longer... call and say, I'm going to be away for a week. Don't call me. Are they off the roster for a week?
If they're not available to be immediately available or ready to perform, then there's an argument that, sure, they should be taken off the roster. People
so
that go
outside.
The
roster, they call the employer and say, take me off the roster. I want to go on a drug toot for a week.
Well, there may be occasions where that is taken into account for purposes of vacation, Your Honor. I can see
that.
Yeah,
they call it vacation.
That's, and then people are called back from vacation.
One of the government's arguments is that if you're right on this position, then the employee would have control over when he's eligible for or liable to random testing.
But I would argue that that vacation example is different from the example that we're talking about here today. The vacation example is one thing that the employer and the employee know, and there's accommodation that is going to begin on one date and end on another date, and there may even be discussion that some people can be called back from vacation. In Dr. Pasternak's case, he hadn't flown for the airline since October 2006, and this was a call that came in June 2007, and his currency had expired at the end of March, and still for 2 more months he had not been called.
Now his license has been revoked?
His license
has. How does he get it back?
In order to regain his licenses, which, Your Honor, as you'll note in the record, he has several licenses with several ratings. The way to get those licenses back would be to retest for all of the certificates and all of the ratings again, which could take an inordinate amount of time and is very expensive to do. And under the facts of this case, especially with the regulations providing that a suspension or revocation may be appropriate for any violation of these regulations, which we believe was not committed, that certainly the revocation, the ultimate sanction, is not appropriate.
But revocation is not irreversible either from what you just said. It's just expensive.
It's very expensive, but it also damages reputation and ability to get future insurance.
What about suspension? Wouldn't that, if he were suspended for the very same complaint, on the basis of the same complaint, wouldn't that damage his reputation equally?
It would too, but not nearly as much so. Suspension is a much different sanction. It sends a different kind of message or impact, and it is something that it can eventually go off someone's record, a revocation, so that any damage, if you will, may be temporary in that sense. Revocation actions are kept on an airman's record for the balance of that airman's career in holding certificates, whereas suspension is expunged.
Pasternak had at one time served as a medical review officer of some sort, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So presumably he was familiar with these regulations.
Yes, Your Honor. He was became a medical review officer. I want to say it was in the late 80s when the regulations were a bit different. And then he...
Was it different in this respect, that failing to complete a test is deemed a refusal?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is something that we've cited in our brief and included in our appendix, the regulation that was in effect at the time that Dr. Pasternak received his designation as a medical review officer.
What was the document in which you said there was a 74-page document with a sentence dealing with this? What document was that?
That is in... I believe, Your Honor, it's appendix.
Current training document?
I believe it's in our addenda.
I think your counsel, co-counsel, or rather, Brother Favar has
joint
it.
Appendix?
Joint appendix, page 323. The document is actually a choice point document that is 20, 30 pages long, but joint appendix 323 is the page that has what you're referring to.
Thank you. Okay, so this, counsel, put this in context.
Sure, Your Honor.
Choice Point is with a trusted contractor for testing?
It's a consortium that does the drug testing on behalf of the Part 135 company for its compliance with the federal regulations.
So who reads this brochure?
This actually is a document that I understand is passed out to the employees when they are trained on the drug and alcohol programs that are conducted by the Part 135 company. So this is the brochure.
Somewhere in here there's a sentence that says failure to take the test is a deemed a refusal, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
And this is, all the employees are expected to have read this?
The inspectors are trained on it.
Pardon me?
The pilots or the people who are within the program are trained on it. I can't tell you if they are expected to have read it.
The fact that he was more up to date on these things in 1989 or that the regs were different then is somewhat beside the point, superseded by this current publication, with which he was supposed to be familiar.
And which he had undergone the training a few years beforehand.
Here
correct.
It is. As on 323, as your brother at the bar said, as an employee, you have refused to take a drug test if you, et cetera, and there are eight things.
Okay. Right, number two.
Okay, so
just like in 4191.
So all of your brief dealing with the portion of it dealing with the disputed issue of whether the employees at the testing center adequately advised Dr. Pasternak is pretty much beside the point. He was advised by this document.
Years before, yes, Your Honor. And again, given his training.
Well, he's supposed to be familiar with it, right? I mean, years before is when he learned to fly, but he's supposed to remember how to do it.
And there is recurrent training on flying so that you can, in fact, show that you do remember how to do it.
Mm-hmm. But apparently there's recurrent training on this because there's a certificate here. It said JA313, signed by Dr. Pasternak, which is dated 5305.
Right. So there's a couple years before this event, right, Your Honor? So and as far as his medical review officer status, there was no requirement at the time that he was a medical review officer to have any sort of recurrent training. That was an issue that came about in the passage of some of these laws, and I believe 2005, 2006, where there was then training which would, as an MRO, highlight to you the regulations and possible changes in the regulations.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. I want to address several points, but getting right to what Judge Ginsburg was just raising with the counsel. First of all, Dr. Pasternak was a medical review officer from 1989, the inception of the MRO program, until 2006. The law changed in 2001 that had what a refusal was to take a drug test. There was recurrent training that had to be done.
He's given permission to leave. Is that a refusal?
If he's given permission to leave the testing site, that first of all, that's not what happened in this case.
I know you studiously avoid answering that question in your brief. I'm just interested in the answer to the question.
Sure. The regulation, which is 40 CFR or 49 CFR .191, is what defines it, and it's kind of what's similar to what we just looked at. That regulation doesn't have a provision that if he's given permission to leave the testing site. However, if I was to make arguments on that side, I would say that he wasn't in violation of the collection process. Which he was in this case, there was two different types of refusals. that were found against him. Right. One was failure.
Well, let me just if the collector had said you can walk around the block for an hour, would that be and then the collector took the test when he returned, and then someone up the chain said no, that's a refusal. Would that be correct?
It would be a more difficult case than this one, absolutely. And
one of the things that's supposed to happen to prevent people from leaving is they're supposed to be informed that if you leave, that constitutes a refusal. That's in the regs.
Well, that's,
and Ms. Montalvo did not do that. Ms. Montalvo violated the regs by not telling them that, correct?
Well, actually, let's
did Ms. Montalvo violate the regs?
No, it's actually not a regulatory requirement.
The regs incorporate the Q&A, which says specifically that you're supposed to be told that if you leave, at least this is the way I read them, the collector must specifically tell the employee that he or she is not permitted to leave the collection site, and if they do so, then it will be considered a refusal to test.
That's
undisputed that didn't happen here, correct?
Well, what actually happened here, and what the testimony, and this is very important.
Can I just get an answer to my question? It's undisputed that didn't happen here.
You're right. She didn't have the opportunity to state that.
Yeah.
That is correct. However, first of all, what you're referring to...
She didn't say that. Now we can talk about why she didn't say that.
Absolutely, and you're right. She didn't say that, and the reason why she didn't say that was that if you look at the testimony, he left very abruptly. She instructed him to wait in the waiting room.
And I'm honing in right on my concern here in this case. This whole thing that she couldn't get it out strikes me as utterly implausible. If you leave, that's a refusal to test. How long does that take to say?
How long does it take to say?
Yeah.
Well, she gave him we have testimony on this. And
if you leave, that's a refusal to test.
Yes.
That's about 3 seconds.
Yeah. And
she couldn't say that?
Well, she testified that she was startled at the time and said, look, I'm going to contact your employer. And as he was walking, he was 10 to 15 feet away already at that point.
If you leave, sir, that's a refusal to test.
If you leave, sir, sure. I mean, that's...
I'll throw in the sir. Make it 4 seconds.
you're right. It's 3 seconds, and it's quick to say. However, I mean, this is a collector...
And she was required by regulation to say it, and the whole purpose of these regulations is that so when someone leaves, we don't have a case like this.
Well...
Because this is why we have Miranda warnings, so that you have a knowing departure with knowledge of the consequences.
Let's back up. There's one thing. It was not a regulatory requirement. What you're talking about is guidance that was issued, but it's not in the regulations that she has to do this. And Dr. Pasternak...
Don't the regs say you must be knowledgeable about this part, the current DOT urine specimen collection procedures guidelines, so the regs then incorporate, you're supposed to know what the guidelines say?
Both the collector and the pilot are supposed to be knowledgeable about that. They both have an equal obligation for that. So there, you could, the pilot has as equal as the collector, the
then why does the collector supposed to say it if the pilot's supposed to know it?
Well, that's in the guidance. That's not in the regulation.
So the guidance just worthless?
The guidance is not just worthless. I mean, it's guidance, but it's not a regulatory requirement.
It says must.
In the guidance. Mm-hmm. It's the guidance. It doesn't say that in the regulation.
Okay. Hear you. It wouldn't have taken long. The NTSB relies in its opinion, it has a sentence that says, we think the preponderance of the evidence also demonstrates that respondents' own behavior at lab court precluded the test administrator from explaining, as specified by Part 40, the shy bladder procedures, or that his departure from the facility prior to the completion of the testing process would constitute a refusal under DOT regulations. So the theory on which the board rests in part is that she was precluded by Pasternak's own behavior, and I still don't get it because it would have taken 3-4 seconds, we've agreed, to get it out.
Well, the facts of this case are very important. And Dr. Pasternak...
No, I've gotten into them.
I see that, and it's a very good thing. The facts of this case state that Dr. Pasternak was uncooperative to begin with. I mean, if you look at the testimony of Teresa Montalvo, he was seemed to be in a hurry. There was, you know, this issue about the cell phone.
Let's just stipulate he might have been a pain.
Sure.
That still doesn't get beyond the point that it takes 3 or 4 seconds to do what the board said she was unable to do. I don't get how she was unable to do
it. She said she testified that she had told him to wait in the waiting room, and she was startled by his reaction where he said, I'm not waiting, I'm leaving.
So startled that she couldn't say, if you leave, that's a refusal to test.
Well, I mean, I think she had, you know, 10 seconds to react. I mean, what kind
that's
of burden?
More, that's more than we've agreed it takes to say the key fact, because then we know he wouldn't have left.
Well, I mean, why do we know that he wouldn't have left?
Because the only reason someone would leave if they knew the consequences would be if they didn't care about losing their certificate, and we can assume, given the litigation that's ensued, that's not right, or if they were on drugs. And he came back for the test 3 hours later. We know that's not true. There's no other human explanation for why, if you knew the consequences, you would leave except for one of those two things.
But that's an assumption that in that period of time he didn't do anything that would have adulterated the process when he came back. I mean, the reason for the drug tests is that if there's any period of time that there's an unexplained refusal and he leaves, he could be doing something that's going to thwart the drug testing process. That's why the MRO cut off the second test.
That's why he's supposed to be told, if you leave, that's a refusal to test.
Well, he had an equal obligation to know that regulation.
That's a good argument.
But I guess moving, I mean, just in general, to address the first point in her argument that the one I think that Judge Brown, you were raising earlier, was that this case really stems, the operative language is that he was subject to a drug test because he was an employee who performs safety sensitive functions. This argument about the fact that he was performing versus perform, I think is really a semantic decision that isn't really applicable. I think one of the things that we know, Your Honors, if there's no more questions, I can take my seat. The FAA respectfully requests that this court uphold the dismissal of Dr. Pasternak's appeal and deny his petition for review.
Mm. Thank you, Mr. Keneally. Counsel, have any time? Further questions for petitioner? Further questions for the petitioner? No. Thank you both. The case is submitted.